Hey, this is Leo for actualize.org, and today I wanted to talk about phenomenology and the importance of first-person experience in personal development and in your own growth. And to maximize your own growth, the importance of observing yourself from the inside and really paying a lot of heed to the experiences that you have going on inside your head day to day. So what I think about is so interesting about phenomenology, and phenomenology is a branch of philosophy that deals with first-person experiences. So phenomenology is all about describing and studying first-person experiences from the first person. So this contrasts to most of the ways that science or psychology or even philosophy approaches certain problems that deal with the mind. Is that usually what happens is that we look at them and we observe them from the outside in, and then we try to make connections. So a psychologist might take a subject and run a bunch of experiments on them, and then from that make deductions about what that person is thinking. Well, phenomenology kind of turns that whole process inside out. So instead of observing subjects or running experiments on them or cutting someone's brain open and studying it from that perspective, what phenomenology does is it studies it from inside. So what you're doing is you're actually going inside your own head and experiencing and then trying to study and actually figure out consistent properties within your own experiences, within your own thoughts, and then draw certain conclusions out of it. So there's a whole history of it. There's a rich history of about 150 years of phenomenological work, and that ties in with philosophy of mind. So what's interesting there, and I think this is so fascinating, is the idea that first-person experiences are actually, a lot of times they're thought of as subjective and kind of flaky and not very important. It's like science is objective, science deals with the external world, and that is the important stuff. I think there's also a lot of importance in the inner world, especially when it comes to self-development work. So one of the most fascinating questions and topics, I think, that I've ever come across from studying a lot of philosophy and psychology and self-development is the idea of qualia. What are qualia? Well, qualia are all the subjective properties that you experience in your day-to-day life. So an example of qualia would be colors. It could also be sounds, the actual perceptions of them. So not the color as it is in the external world, but the color as it is perceived by you in your consciousness. So what we're really talking about here is consciousness and various aspects of it. So all the different qualities of consciousness, those are what we would call qualia. What's interesting about them is that they're completely personal and subjective. So they only happen to you. And there's no really good way to even talk about them with the standard scientific models. So I think one of the most fascinating, in fact, problems left for science is figuring out a way to reconcile and to really explain what qualia are. Because on the one hand, it seems like qualia are the things that are most real because they are what we commonly know from our experience. They're the things that we know most intimately. On the other hand, there's really no way to even compare experiences of one person to the other person just to see if they even match up. And how do you even start describing qualia? It's so personal. Just the very fact that I have a certain color shirt on right now and that I'm experiencing it in my consciousness as red is very particular to me. And you might also experience it as red, but that feeling of redness that you're getting, that you're sensing, there's no good scientific way to talk about it or to describe it. You can talk about the wavelengths of red. You can say everything there is to know about the science of red, but that whole description, you could read a whole textbook on it, but that description of red will never actually get you the feeling of red and the experience of red, the qualia of red. So it's a very interesting topic, I think, that science is going to have to come to grips with, because it's, on the one hand, right now, what kind of mainstream science does is it almost discounts the importance of qualia or the fact that they exist, saying that, well, all this mental phenomenon can be boiled down to neurological activity in the brain. And while that's that seems like to be likely to be the case from all the developments in neuroscience, is it seems like it is in fact the case that the neurons in your brain and the activity that's going on there, the electrical impulses that are firing off, all of that stuff is ultimately giving rise to your consciousness and to your feelings and your experiences. But the question still remains, if we take the brain and let's say we just kind of magnify it up, and then we were to walk around on the inside of it and to look around, the analogy is like if we take an old sawmill and we go inside the old sawmill and we look around. If the brain is the sawmill and we look around and we walk around it, we can do a thorough inspection and we'll never ever find the quality of red inside the sawmill. So no matter how good neuroscience gets, you're never going to find the quality of red in the brain, at least not in that same way that we're talking about. You can try to reduce it and boil it down to some physical phenomenon, but in the end, it's very hard to deny, because we all experience it firsthand, that there's something to this consciousness thing. So I think that's a really interesting, just like an interesting, fascinating topic, and it's a great lead-in into what I want to really talk about, which is the importance of observing yourself, and observing yourself from the first person as you try to grow yourself, because I think that's a larger aspect of self-discovery, and I think it's also the foundation of it. A few more points on phenomenology and kind of some of the quirkiness of experience and consciousness. One interesting case that I'm going to bring to you is called the Molyneux problem, and the Molyneux problem came about in 1688. This was a long time ago. In 1688, an Irish scientist and politician by the name of William Molyneux, introduced this idea to John Locke. He basically sent him a letter and he posed this little thought experiment. It was a philosophical type of thought experiment. What would happen if a man was born blind and grew up blind, and then all of a sudden he gained his vision back? Now the question is, would that man be able to distinguish by looking at a sphere right next to a cube? So let's say you have a spherical object next to a cubical object. Just by sight alone, would that man be able to distinguish which one of them is spherical and which one of them is cubical? So this has to do with how our perception and vision connects with our sense of touch. So presumably what would happen there is that the man would grow up blind, but he would be touching objects. So he'd have a good sense of sharpness and roundness of objects. So if he felt spherical objects and he felt cubical objects, he would presumably have a lot of experience with how that felt, what roundness felt like, and what sharpness and sharp edges felt like. So once he has that, but then he never attached the sense of vision to it, so he doesn't really know what a sphere looks like. He doesn't really know what a cube would look like. When he does have that ability all of a sudden turned on, let's say, is he going to be aware of which one is the round thing and which one is the square thing? So what do you think? How would you answer that question? Would you say that he could or that he couldn't? Well, this was a long-standing philosophical debate, which Molyneux introduced to Locke, and then Locke talked about it. And then really philosophers talked about it for centuries, and they tried to do experiments on it, but it's actually really hard to do this kind of experiment because it's very rare. The cases where someone is born blind and then all of a sudden gains their vision back is very rare, let alone after that, at that precise moment when the vision is gained back, to have some philosopher or scientist then run that kind of experiment on them. So the results were mixed and it was hard to figure that out. Now, what's interesting to me is that I always assumed that the answer would be no, that the blind man would not be able to automatically distinguish roundness from squareness, because that's something that you have to build up through experience. At least that was kind of my intuition about it. But it's kind of freaky to think that it would actually be that way, right? If squareness and roundness are really quite distinct from our feeling of them is very distinct from our seeing them, because we tend to assume, I think the common notion is to assume that the two go hand in hand, and that if something feels round, it looks round, and the two are very, very coupled. So what's actually interesting is that in 2003, there was a study done in India where there were 5 patients that actually had this rare condition where they were born blind, and then at around the age, in adolescence, like age 15 to 18, they were treated for blindness using modern technologies and medicines, and they suddenly got their vision back. And so this was a perfect opportunity to run the test, and that actually what happened is that they did run the tests, and what they discovered was that indeed the ability of the subject who used to be blind and now could see to distinguish between a sphere and a cube was slightly above 50%. So it was almost like they were guessing. They did slightly better than guessing. So what that basically says is that indeed the two are decoupled, and that your sense of being able to distinguish roundness from squareness visually is different from your ability to distinguish it tactically. So to me, that kind of confirmed my own hypothesis, but it's interesting that it is that way, right? It's a little bit freaky. I think the relevance of this thing, of this experiment and this whole Molyneux problem, besides the fact that it's just kind of freaky and interesting and fascinating, is the fact that what we think and what we really attribute to being very real or part of our construct of reality and the way that we experience it firsthand, phenomenologically, is really a lot of construct, a lot of stuff. It's not like we're just passively picking up everything that's coming at us. A lot of our understanding of reality and really our whole conception of reality is us projecting a lot of ourselves onto it. So I think that has a lot of deep kind of roots, and just gets you to start thinking about kind of what else in your life are you really just kind of projecting out there, and what are you taking for granted in your perceptions? What are you taking for granted in how you think the world works? What are you taking, you know, what parts of reality that you think are just really solid and really real are actually just habits that you have? So interesting example. Another interesting example that I'm going to throw out to you is the reverse spectrum problem, also a classical philosophical problem, kind of along the same lines as the Molyneux problem. And this basically just says that how do we know that two observers experience qualia in the same way? Specifically, we're talking about color here. So how do we know, for example, that, like, we all agree that this shirt right here that I have on is red. The question is, how do we know that my perception of this color red is exactly the same as your perception of it? Well, this is an interesting problem, because even though we can take, you know, we can take a microscope and we can analyze the fabric, and we can look at the light waves bouncing off of it, and we completely understand the whole mechanics of light and optics and how it's picked up in the brain, how it's picked up in the eye, and all of that, the fact is that that's not really what the question is concerning. The question is more concerning the first person experience, that qualia that we talked about, right? So the question is, how do we know that my qualia are the same as your qualia? It could very well be the case, at least hypothetically speaking, that what I'm perceiving as red and what I'm calling red is what you're actually perceiving as blue but calling red. And we could still completely agree on everything, and our language would work. In the real world, everything that we talk about, we'd still be able to make sense of it, but we would just have different experiences. And because those experiences are completely first person, completely subjective and inner, and never accessible to either one of us, they're only accessible to the person that's experiencing them, then we would never be able to really compare side by side and ever to be able to to say which whether there is a difference or there's not, even though we're calling it the same red. So what happens is if all the reds in your reality, in your mind, were actually the kind of what I would see as blues in your reality, but I would see them as blues in my reality, but we'd agree on labels. So this is an interesting example, and it just demonstrates kind of the trickiness and the slipperiness of what qualia are, and I think it lends some interesting weight to first person experiences, because really the defining property of them is that they can only be known by the observer. So they're always private. We can only guess that other people know what we're talking about when we say red, but you can't ever be completely sure. So that's also interesting in the sense that it also kind of pulls the blanket back, right? Pulls the curtain back and lets us think that if that is a possibility, then again, how much of reality are we really projecting out there ourselves? What if the way that I experience the world is my world is completely colored differently than yours? It's kind of freaky to think about that. Like, I'm walking around and looking around and I'm seeing colors, and you're walking around and you're seeing the exact inverse of those colors. And yet we can still communicate and everything still works just fine. And in fact, maybe that is exactly the case. Yet we assume that everyone around us sees exactly what we see. Yet we have no real proof of that. And the even weirder thing is that it's not even clear how we would get proof of that. The only way to do that would be to somehow be able to meld my mind with your mind and do some sort of inner conscious comparing. But there's no way, we don't even know if that's possible or how that would be done if it were possible. So very interesting examples that kind of start getting you to really think about some of the magical properties of consciousness and what it really is. Also demonstrates that a lot of this stuff is not as simple as reducing it down to physical things that we would normally consider physical in the real world. And I'm not saying that your consciousness is some magical woo-woo thing or a ghost or whatever, but it also is very clear that you can't just discount qualia completely, because there's something that's quite real and quite important to us, especially when we're talking about first-person experiences. So, you know, what does all this mean? What does this all have to do with self-development? Well, I think the bedrock of self-development, as I've discovered, is really self-observation, is self-understanding. And it's easy to discount that because it seems so fundamental and so basic. But on the other hand, I think it's also critical to get it right. I think the trick is that most of us deceive ourselves as to how well we really know ourselves, how conscious we really are of ourselves. We assume that we are, but actually, a lot of times we're quite shocked when we discover that what we thought we knew was not actually what we really knew. And I think in self-development, this is really important, is when you're starting to try to work on yourself and you're working through your own issues, you're working through your own reactions and your own views and interpretations of the world and your own beliefs, you start to see, like, you start to almost see these fissures in the matrix. You start to see that your world and how you construct it is really like living in a matrix, and you start to see certain places where it kind of starts to break down. It's like you start to see these little cracks. You start to see the cracks, and you start to see that really what I thought was out there is actually in here, and I'm projecting a lot of the stuff out onto the world. And when you start to realize that, a lot of possibilities open up for you. First of all, you start to take a lot more responsibility on yourself for managing how you feel, for managing your own thoughts and your own beliefs. And then you also start to wonder, and you start to really get that very freaky matrix-like feeling, like you can start to get a control and a sense of agency over this stuff. So stuff that you thought that was triggering you outside, you start to see, like, huh, that's actually what's actually happening there, is that, sure, I'm getting provoked from the outside by a certain stimulus, but then the reaction is happening within me. And that reaction is something that you can actually learn to control. And, if you like the reaction, you can keep it. If you don't like it, you can certainly learn to to kind of override it and change the mechanisms to the point where you're having the same stimulation, but then the reaction that you're having is totally different or it doesn't affect you at all. So it can give you almost those kind of matrix-like properties where if you believe it enough, then you start to be able to do crazy stuff like jump from buildings to buildings and fly and do this kind of crazy stuff. The thing is that it's hard to even see that this is possible unless you start to really get a lot of inner awareness and inner development. I think that's critical to do successful self-development because you really need to start to develop a deep understanding of the forces that are driving you on the inside. So that first person, that first person experience, I think that's discounted a lot in our society and also in literature and books and that kind of stuff, because everyone talks about the external stuff, the third person, the stuff that's kind of objective, and few people talk about really the subjective experiences, which are still very important. You know, what are the subjective experiences that you have of achieving any of the goals that you want? So whether it's earning more money or getting fit, eating healthier, getting a better relationships, you know, what are like the pains and the struggles that you're experiencing? And then also what are the good things? And then getting a better understanding of that, getting an understanding of what exactly you want in all those situations and what you don't want is critical. And I think it's very highly discounted. In fact, there's an interesting development here that I want to introduce, which is that a man by the name of Peter Uspensky, back in the early 1900s, worked with another guy who was kind of a European mystic, and his name was Gurdjieff. So Gurdjieff and Uspensky, they did some writings and they did a lot of study on how to do personal improvement and how to do kind of evolution and get personal evolution, personal growth. And they did some lectures, they wrote some books on this. And one of the books is called, I have it here, it's Uspensky's The Psychology of Man's Possible Evolution. And really this is a very interesting text to go to because it really talks about what it takes to evolve yourself as a human being. And it talks about some of the nuances of it and some of the core fundamental problems. So I want to read you some excerpts from it because I think it's really powerful and it starts to frame all of self-development, because it's not just about going in there. I think the problem with self-development viewed as just behavior change or going in there and trying to get, you know, a quick little fix like losing 5 pounds here or getting some more money in your bank account there. I think that's not, it can work sometimes. I don't think it leads to the best long-term results. I think if you want to look at self-development long-term as something that can really transform your life, you have to look at it on that long-term basis. And you have to look at it as something that you do throughout your life. It's just you try to better understand yourself and you try to gain mastery over yourself, which is something that I call self-mastery. And, you know, what is the process of self-mastery? How does it work? If you're interested in it, how do you go about it? So these are all fascinating questions. And then, of course, what are the challenges of self-mastery? So let me read you a little bit of Uspensky's thoughts on this matter. And if you're really interested in it, you can pick this up and kind of take it off from there. And I'll share you some of my thoughts about it as well. So here's what Uspensky says in Psychology of Man's Possible Evolution. In order to become different, man must want it very much, and for a very long time. A passing desire or a vague desire based on dissatisfaction with external conditions will not create sufficient impulse. The evolution of man depends on his understanding of what he may get and what he must give for it. If man does not want it, or if he does not want it strongly enough and does not make the necessary efforts, he will never develop. In becoming a different being, man acquires many new qualities and powers which he does not possess now. But before acquiring any new faculties or powers which man does not now possess, he must acquire faculties and powers he also does not possess, but which he ascribes to himself. Now, this is an important point. He clarifies this. That is, man thinks that he knows that he has these powers and that he can use and control them, but in fact, he can't. Man must acquire qualities which he thinks he already possesses, but about which he deceives himself. So this is where it gets interesting. The chief, and then there are, he starts going through and talking about some of the ways in which we deceive ourselves. And so I'm not going to go through all of them because that would take quite a bit of time. But here's probably the biggest point. So there's a very important fact. And the most important fact in which you deceive yourself, as, quote, Uspensky says, man does not know himself. He does not know his own limitations and his own possibilities. He does not even know how great an extent he doesn't know himself. I think this is a really good analogy right here. Man has invented many machines, and he knows that a complicated machine needs sometimes years of careful study before man can use or control it. But man does not apply this knowledge to himself, although he himself is a much more complicated machine than any machine that has ever been invented. So what does all that mean? Well, I think Uspensky is brilliant, Gurdjieff and Uspensky. What I really took from them is the importance that if you're going to be doing self-development, is the importance of starting to really observe yourself and what you're doing and why what you're doing is causing problems for you and the problems of behavior change that come about. So how does this really apply to our everyday lives? Well, it really means that the powers that you think you have, the willpowers you think you have, the consciousness that you think you possess is actually quite deceptive. In fact, what Uspensky argues for is that most of us are walking around in a sleeping daze, in that we think that we are conscious, but most of the times you are not actually conscious. You are not self-conscious, as it might be said. So you're going through your day, you're doing routines, you're running through habits, and you're acting very robotic-like. You're acting almost like a machine, even though you would never admit it. But the fact of the matter is that next time you're running through your day, stop. Just randomly stop throughout the day and observe the thoughts that are going through your head. Observe what it is that you're doing. Kind of observe yourself. And you'll start to see that, oh my God, I was just running through this whole spiel, this whole routine, and just now that I stopped, I suddenly noticed what I was doing. So it starts to get you to see that your body and that your mind and you as an organism is really, that you are a very complex machine with a lot of subroutines and a lot of components that run on autopilot, right? So you have an unconscious mind, you have a conscious mind, but a lot of times the stuff that you're doing throughout your day is very habitual, very routine. And so this is important to understand when we start talking about wanting to change behaviors, because if you're talking about losing some weight, or you're talking about running your business differently, or you're talking about leaving your job and starting your own business, or you're talking about switching careers, well, that starts to involve behavior change and all the forces that come into play there. I think the biggest problem is that when we start to want some of these things, we don't realize and don't really understand from a first-person experience what these forces are. We haven't identified them, we haven't labeled them, we have very little experiences changing them. And so then when we do, because of that ignorance, it's like a fog that leads most people to just kind of grasp around in the dark, try this or that randomly, and then leads to failure just because we're not equipped with the challenges that are there. Just even appreciating the challenges is very important. So, you know, next time you're doing something that you told yourself that you wouldn't do anymore, like let's say you are on a diet and you're trying to lose some weight, and you tell yourself that you're going to be eating clean, and then you run off to the pantry and you grab a bag of chips and you start stuffing your face with chips, look at yourself doing that, because chances are when you're doing that, you're acting on autopilot, and you're acting and you're driven by forces that you don't even realize are quite there, that you haven't really inspected. So inspect what's really going on there. And you'll see something interesting is that if you're lucky to be conscious, to catch yourself in that moment, you're going to be grabbing that chip out of the bag and you're going to be putting it up to your mouth, and then you can kind of pause and just kind of do a little self-reflective activity and just see, oh my God, what's happening here? I have this chip that's I'm about to put in my mouth. I told myself I wouldn't do this, but yet I'm doing it, and I'm driven by these forces. And then just kind of observe yourself doing it, right? It's like the automatic part of you that is still running on one of those routines is doing this stuff, and then yet your conscious mind is looking at it, it's seeing it. In that case, if you are lucky enough and you kind of summon the fortitude to be conscious there, and yet a lot of times it's still powerless to do it, to do anything about it. It's still powerless to change it. And so that's kind of how it starts, is you have to start to see yourself engaging in these behaviors, engaging in these activities, and you have to start to and really appreciate the forces there, because your willpower is limited and your consciousness is limited. You're not always in a high conscious state. A lot of times you're in low consciousness mode, or you're completely unconscious and you're totally in autopilot. And yet that's how most of our lives are lived. So to do effective behavior change, to do effective personal growth, starting to see that, starting to learn that, and then you have to become clever and tricky and really outsmart your own self, outsmart your own biology, outsmart your own thinking patterns. Because to make an effective change in your life, a lot of times what's required is thinking in a roundabout way how to achieve your results. So instead of saying that, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to force myself not to eat any chips ever again. And then you're running on willpower and you think that's going to be great. You think that's the strategy you're going to take to lose weight. And then what happens is you last out one day, you last out 2 days, everything's good. Then 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, and then 10 days later on the 10th day, well, what happens? You start focusing on something else. You focus on the problems that you're having at work. You focus on your relationship. You focus on something else in your life. And then all of a sudden, you find yourself walking towards the pantry to grab a bag of chips, right? Because your willpower is starting to drain. Or you quite simply just start to lose focus and start to even forget about the original intentions that you set for yourself. So starting to realize that these are real forces in your own head that you're dealing with, that you're grappling with, I think is very important to do effective personal change. And so the foundation of it all, there's no easy answers here. What does all this mean? It just means that you have to become a lot more observant about your own patterns. You have to start becoming more observant about what you're doing in your life, and really putting a lot more importance in the kind of feelings that you have, the kind of beliefs that you have, the kind of thoughts that you have. Like a good exercise, for example, is to just randomly, a few times throughout the day, stop and just monitor your own thoughts. Just drop everything you're doing in your day and just stop and monitor your own thoughts, and then see, what am I thinking right now? What have I been thinking for the last 5 minutes? Has it been a bunch of worry? Has it been a bunch of anxious nonsense? Was I thinking about the fight I had with my boss? Was I thinking about the vacation that's coming up 2 weeks from now and I was caught up in that? Was I having an imaginary argument with somebody in my head? Was I thinking a bunch of negative thoughts about how everything's going to go horribly wrong tomorrow at this dinner party that I'm going to? So those kinds of things usually happen to us automatically. And a good chunk of your day, if you really think about it, a good chunk of your day is spent in those kinds of unresourceful states. And that is where you want to do a lot of work, because that's where you can get very big gains, eliminating those kinds of thoughts, working on them and finding ways and using techniques to work on that stuff.